Okay, thank you everyone. Thank you for coming to this panel on fiscal rules in the EU looking forward, both to the ones here as well as to the many on Zoom. We're very happy to host this panel. It is an important debate for the European Union moving forward and one that is very active and happening right now. We have four very distinguished speakers. The first one is going to be Marco Buti. Marco is a graduate of Florence and Oxford. He's been working at the European Commission since 1986. And for many years, he was the head of the Director General of Economics and Finance. Since 2019, I believe, he's now been the head of cabinet for Commissioner Gentiloni. Marco, aside from being then a very involved policymaker in Europe for now many years, has also kept a remarkable intellectual production in terms of books and articles, including a wonderful book that I recommend to everyone that came out 2021, I think, explaining his journey within the Commission over the two crises of, well, the last 10 or 15 years, Journey Through Crisis, I believe, is an insider account from the man inside. And Marco's always been a wonderful expositor of ideas, and I'm very happy that he agreed to come and join us. The second speaker is going to be Federica Romei. Federica has a PhD from Luis in Rome in 2014. She taught at the Stockholm School of Economics, and she's been at Oxford now for a few years. She just recently won an ERC starting grant, and Federica has done quite a bit of influential work on sovereign default in monetary unions, as well as more generally on the deleveraging process, that is the process through which debts are paid, which is, of course, extremely important as we discuss fiscal rules under the high debt environment of the EU. Third speaker is going to be Gene Frieda. Gene is currently an executive vice president of PIMCO. He is a master's from the LSE, a great honor, of course. And he has been around macro policy and financial markets for a very long and distinguished career, at More Capital for many years. And he's one of the sharpest commentators on macro affairs from being able to blend in both deep analysis with especially a market angle. Finally, our fourth speaker is going to be our own Ethan Ilzetsky, who's been at the LSE, I believe, since 2009 or 10. He's an associate professor with us, also has an ERC consolidator grant, and has done a lot of extremely important work on measuring the efficacy of fiscal stimulus, the need to expand the tax base, and more generally on the impact of government spending on output, sometimes called the multipliers. So, with those introductions, that's the order in which we're going to speak. We're going to speak for 15 minutes. After that, we're going to do a Q&A round among ourselves, and then open to the audience for questions. So with that in mind, Marco, please, probably better if you come here, and should be able to, wait. Or is it? You know where it is? Sorry, early.
Right. Okay, thank you very much. Thanks, Ricardo. You mentioned my book, 2021, is already two crises ago. in counting. What I'd like to do with you is to go through a bit what inspired the proposal of the Commission for reforming the EU fiscal framework. So where we come from, an explanation, a bit a snapshot on what we are proposing, and then I bring you to up to date on the discussion on the policy and the next steps. So the first one, okay, to start with is, if we try to solve a problem, we have to try to identify what the problems are. So here you have the current fiscal framework, so it's a snapshot on the main tenets of the fiscal framework, then the problems that over so many years that we have encountered in implementing the framework. So We have in the EU fiscal rules what we call a preventive arm and a corrective arm. So preventive arm is when you are not under strict surveillance, so you coordinate policies, but you are not in you know, under huge pressure because of you have to to correct what you are doing. So this is the anchor of this is a medium-term objective, which is around balancing structural terms. And then if you are departing or if you are far away from that, you have have a path to get there through a quasi-uniform adjustment, again, in the structural balance towards the MTO. The MTO is, as I said, between, let's say, minus one plus one. And if you do not get there, there is a significant deviation procedure in which we increase a bit the pressure on the government. So we have the social balance, but we have also a spending rule complementing the social balance, and we have some investment in structural reform clause to modulate somehow the adjustment. When you get into the corrective arm, and here the yardstick is what everybody knows, is the 3% headline deficit. Then you get into stronger surveillance. So if you go above and in a persistent, sizable manner, then you enter the EDP, excessive deficit procedure. This is in the case of the deficit, so 3%, and then you have the debt-based excessive deficit procedure, which is linked to the debt. You have the other threshold in the reference value in the treaty is the 60%. So if you are not there, in principle, you should reduce it by 1/20 per year, in normal times. What are the problems of this? It's complexity. So you have seen, I mentioned already several indicators. The pace of debt reduction, so the 1/20 is that you should reduce by 1/20 between the level of debt and the 60%. So it's the gap between the two, 1/20 has proven to be pretty tough to me. So we have not really implemented that. We have typically a pro-cyclical bias in good times and bad times. So. And this is, I think it applies to life in general, that we are all pro-cyclical, in our personal behavior also. But, we try here, the EU is trying to make sure that you are a bit less pro-cyclical. Basically restricting in bad times because you have misbehaving in good times, when largesse due to the automatic stabilizer with, revenue flowing in, et cetera. We have an investment in a structural reform clause there, allowing somewhat modulation of the adjustment, but objectively very limited incentives to put the money where your mouth is, also in terms of overall priorities. This has resulted in lack of ownership. So there is a bit of Brussels sending you recommendations and targets. Not so much, so it's lived a bit as an external pressure, not as really owned. And all this has led to relatively low enforcement. And as I mentioned, the debt-based DP never was open. So you have seen the problems, the current situations, or what, in a snapshot, this is what we propose. So we try to increase national ownership. So because if you commit to something that comes from yourself, ideally you have better incentives to then respect what you have committed to. And second, there is more legitimacy also institutionally than to tell you, look, you should behave because it's your own objective. So then the second big block is to try to simplify, and then we have all this leads to, should lead to better enforcement. I'm not going to go through all the steps in detail, but national ownership is essentially, the Commission kicks off with some reference path for net spending. This should be taken into account by the member states, but they can come forward with their own fiscal structural plans, so fiscal, but also factoring in the reforms and investment that they want to do. And if usually we take 4 years, in our proposal we have 4 years medium-term plans, that can be extended to 7 years, or if you have moderate debt even beyond, if you do the right reform and you put the resources in investment. So longer adjustment period. There is the evaluation of the Commission and Council endorsement. We simplify because the net expenditure path, it becomes the single fiscal indicators. We do away with all the rest, and we get rid of the 1/20th, 0.5 on any other the other set of indicators that we have. Basically, once they are a government has put forward a plan, this has been assessed and assessed by the Commission, endorsed by the Council, so by the member states, you are supposed to respect your plan. Obviously, you have escape clauses in case of fluctuations, in case of crisis, external shocks, etc. But you are supposed to respect your plans by and large. So, and then there is enforcement. The excessive deficit based on the deficit itself, so the 3% is not going to change. We don't change neither the 3% nor the 60%. They are in the treaty. It would be far too cumbersome and lengthy to change those. You need unanimity, you need ratification of procedures in national parliaments. Too long. So, and we operationalize the debt EDP, so basically you have a path for your debt and the corresponding net expenditure pattern, and then if you deviate in a significant way from there for not good reasons, then you end up in EDP. We have financial sanctions now, but financial sanctions very hard to apply to a sovereign state. So, and also they are pretty large now, 0.2% of GDP and et cetera. So they are a bit the nuclear option. Don't talk about nuclear now these days, but nonetheless. So what they propose is to have to go for more smaller sanctions, a bit more symbolic and more reputational. So we have a better chance, I think, to implement them. And then also macroeconomic conditionality means that if you are in excessive deficit, you do not respect the the new targets set by the Council, then you can freeze some of the other spending. So now, okay, we are in a more academic environment, so I try to capture this in a very simplified manner. So I think this is for you to look at afterwards rather than all going ahead. But what you can see here, basically, you can see equation one is the convergence of the debt towards B bar, which is essentially, if you can take the 60%, which is in the treaty. So as long as you are down, with a debt higher than 60%, you should gradually reduce it. The beta here is you can see here, it depends on, here, I don't know if it works. Okay, beta here, okay. It is B beta bar, which is the 120 that I mentioned before. So if you do not, if you keep the present rules, then sigma is zero and you have 120. Now what we want to do is to have a more gradual adjustment, so you have a lower gradient, so a lower space of debt reduction if you implement structural reforms, which is R here, okay? So this is the way to capture this thing. Then you have equation two is the debt accumulation standard equation. Here, then, I have assumed that the interest rate, you have risk-free interest rate plus a risk premium. And I assume here that the risk premium depends on the size of the debt. You can have different, different expressions, but that is an easy one. And I assume also that growth depends on the structural reforms, right? So I do all this, I solve for the primary surplus, and the expression of the primary surplus is basically the one that you see here. What you get there is that if you do structural reforms, you gain a bit more gradual adjustment, and if you do structural reforms, you gain via the denominator. Okay, so you can see here B bar is the what structural reforms help you either via boosting the economy, boosting GDP, or via gaining a bit more room for maneuver, right? Okay, so this is the thing. And if you are if you believe the story that risk premium spreads depends on the the size of the debt in excess of the reference value, then you can also gain on that. Then a stronger enforcement should lead to lower primary surplus. So this is the left-hand side. Now the right-hand side, I make here I venture into the purely speculative thing, because what you have, I assume here the fiscal behavior that the government, what does the government do? It wants to be re-elected, right? So it minimizes a quadratic loss function where it wants to be close to P hat, which is the primary balance that is for politically motivated reasons you want to, it allows to give you bonuses and things to buy consensus. So you want as far as possible to be close to that. And here in this expression here, structural reforms are costly politically. So you arbitrate between the two, and you in what you find here, and I leave it to you for the discussion later if you like, you have the optimal R star, which is this expression here. This you have there. So that is the that is the way to capture in a very simplified manner. You have three here. You have three channels, 1, 2, and 3, that you find also in this representation here. So this is the triangle where I put together the channel one with financial sustainability, financial stability. Through the positive impact on risk premia. So you have a confidence effect. You have a political feasibility because you have more gradualism in the adjustment. See, this is the second channel. And the third one is what helps in terms of productivity, sustainable growth, green and digital transition, which is the incentives for reforms and investment. So this is, conceptually, in a nutshell, what we are trying to do with the new rules. So 1, 2, and 3 channels, how do you substantiate this and exemplify this? This is the first channel, which is, have more gradual adjustment. This is a country which is not named here, but if you go above 140% of GDP, it looks like a southern country where I come from. And what you can see here is that if you do no adjustment, unchanged policies, you have the dotted line, so debt to GDP continues to go, to grow. If you apply the present rules, the 1/20th, you can see it. You can see it here is the one that requires actually a pretty steep reduction of the debt. Then the MTO, so it means that you apply the rules of moving and then respecting the medium-term objective of broadly balanced structural budget, then it is the yellow here. And you can see that the 4-year period simulated, or the 7 years under the assumption that you get a more gradual adjustment, you can see that you have a bit more, a smoother path. So, in principle, this should help on political feasibility. Second, the channel is, favoring in providing incentives for reforms and investment. Here, I have put some numbers which come from our estimates on the green and digital transition. So, what you need to do for till 2030 for the EU, we have an additional estimates of 650 billion per year. I think with the war and moving away from dependency on Russian fossil fuel, you need probably even more. So this is 300 billion. Just to say, okay, don't take this number too literally, but you need a quite substantive investment over the next several years. So the idea here is to have a framework which, you know, should provide incentives by allowing a smoother adjustment to put the money to the right cause. So and the fact that we move away from an annual budget to a multi-annual budget, which should allow, I think, a better planning. The focus, by the way, this is on basis essentially potential and sustainable growth. But if you think about the more cyclical pattern of the spending, the fact that we focus on nominal spending should reduce the pro-cyclical bias, because when you have higher inflation, then automatically in real terms expenditure goes down, and vice versa when you are in a slump. So it has a built-in anti-cyclical behavior. Okay, this is the second. This is the third. So it was on financial stability, financial sustainability, and here, okay, Jean may tell us something later, also in the light of what is happening right now. Okay, since we have moved from QE to QT, or moving to there, I think you have seen, okay, spreads have they have increased. They remain contained, but these days. Beware of horizontal and vertical lines in the markets. No? You have benign neglect until you don't. No? So the fact of having here, especially for high debt countries, more vulnerable countries, having a framework which ensures, if properly applied, good sustainability of public finances, I think should help reassure the markets also and lower the pressure there. So, and there is also an institutional element. You see the last bullet here, which is the ECB willingness to activate the transmission protection instrument. Is actually depends on the implementation of an credible fiscal rule. So that also should reassure on that front in case interest rates go out of the out of the way for no particular reason, simply because of self-fulfilling negative dynamics. Good. I think this is my final slide. Next steps. So what we have here, what I have told you so far, was encapsulated in the November 2022 communication by the Commission, which outlines the system should work. It's a communication, it's not a legal text, but we try to be as detailed as possible there. We have had 10 days ago, or even less than 10 days ago, the ministers reached a conclusion on, after a long debate on where to go on the fiscal frameworks, which essentially listed the points of convergence. I think there are certain elements, number of elements which still needs to be worked on. We have to continue the dialogue, and the Council expressed the intention to conclude the legislative work by the end of 2023. This is important also because next year we have the European elections, and we know that is the end of the legislature. So if we do not have an agreement by then, the risk is to draw a line and start anew, which I think would be very problematic in the light of the market, also in the light of market volatility. So what is happening now? I said the communication is not a legal text, but we are going to propose a legal text amending the whole legislative framework of the pact by in April. I said here to be confirmed, just to be on the safe side, but I think by the end of April the intention is to come forward with the actual legislative proposals which implements all this in legal terms, and then we'll have the negotiations between Council and Parliament during the rest of the year. The idea would be to have sometimes in the course of the first half of next year a full agreement on this. So this is what is in front of us.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. Hi. So, thank you to be here. One second. So, some of you maybe know, some of you don't know, but this is my first day after maternity leave. So, it's like I have a 3 months old daughter. So, this means when Riccardo asked me to come here, I was super stressed because I spent the last 3 months staying a lot with kids and parents of kids. And so I was thinking that I would not be able to solve this such complicated problem. But then I found myself in a restaurant with different parents, and I think, like, if you have kids, you have to solve this problem that there are kids running around, there are different families with different framework and institution. And what happened there is that my husband tend to be very, very strict on my daughter, right? So it's like there were these kids running around, and then my husband went to my daughter, Guy, and said, you can't run. I mean, I don't want you to run in the restaurant. It's very bad, it's very unpolite. So Gaia, I mean, she's an obedient girl, so she was like, okay, daddy, I'm not going to run. And then she went to the kids, and she say, my daddy told me that we should not run, so let's not run. And I mean, it was a rule, a very simple rule, and they implemented. But then Gaia looked at her best friend and she say, my daddy told me that we can't run, but he never told me that we can't hope like rabbits. Mm. So all these kids start to hope like rabbits in the restaurant, and I look at my husband saying, you know, this is the problem. You want to implement a very strict rule. And then they found a way to circumvent. And at that point you couldn't say to our daughter, now you can't hope, because she would find something else to do. So I was there and I started to think about this interaction, and I thought that the problem that we were solving as a family is it was very similar to the problem of the fiscal union, right? Of the monetary union. So there are like many families, you can think the parents are the different institution or people that work. And then there are all these kids, this nation, that also they are related to the different families. And we want them to behave, but it's very difficult to assess or to say what does it mean to behave. So I was thinking like just some characteristic that a fiscal rule should have. And I mean, I think Mark also touched on that part on this new plan. So the first characteristic of a fiscal rule, I think that is important to be a fiscal rule, is the flexibility, right? So in the example that I give you, my husband was giving a very strict rule to our daughter, but this rule didn't take into account different state of the world. It was only you can't run, but you can do. But what my husband wants her to do is that she should behave. But in some sense, he should do a rule that was much more flexible than the one that he was implementing in the moment. On the other side, the problem is that if you go too flexible, then it's not clear what you want to do, because you need to behave. It means different things within different families. So I think that there is a trade-off between being clear. So I mean, the 3% deficit is a very clear rule. On the other side, it could be that you can find way to circumvent this rule, right? Maybe, I think recently there was something in Italian where they were accounting something like debt, and then instead it was flow, and then they changed the norm. So in some sense, there is a big trade-off. A second characteristic of a rule, and I think Marco touched on that, should be the enforceability or time consistency. I don't know which one you want to use as a term. And what's the problem there? The problem is that, so here we have a paper and I'm going to more serious, is the fact that when bad camps arrive, right? So when, for example, when there was the debt crisis and we want the country not to default, or we want the country to default, but we don't want to bail out the country, then what happened is that is the same structure of the monetary union. So the fact that the structure of Mandel, or the fact that this country has a lot of interconnection, adapt in a way that if a country will default, for example, this will have a lot of spillovers on other countries, right? And it could be direct spillovers. So you can think Italy, I mean, Germany holds some Italian debt, so Germany doesn't want Italy to default, because when Italy defaults, then they will lose some financial wealth. And then Marco can say, oh, but we tackled this, right? So, I mean, not Marco, but the European institution, they will say, okay, but now this was a problem of the previous crisis, but we tackled that. We now debt is like much more like spread all around, and there is not anymore this problem. But there is a second problem, that is there are also spillovers towards the demand. So if so, there is a lot of trade among this country. I think if there is a big drop in southern demand, this will have an effect on the northern country. And so in some sense, when we are close to default, there is an incentive also from the northern country to say, no, let's bail out this country, because this is going to have an effect on us as well. So the problem, I think this is a very important problem, and it's very difficult to solve, especially for the same reason. So the reason why we made the monetary union, that is we have all this interconnection, is also the same reason that make difficult to make a rule, a fiscal rule that is time consistent, because when bad times will arrive, we want to save this country, because we know that like this country being in a bad condition means that also we're going to be in a bad condition. Now there's going to be a third characteristic. This is not, just three things, but so that should be also fairness. So we saw that before, what happened is that there was a sort of different treatment between a small country and big country. If a small country default, or if a small country misbehave, then everybody's like, okay, no, you need to behave. But if it's a big country that has a lot of influence in the monetary union, then maybe you should behave, but a little bit less, right? So I think this is the first thing to take into account, that we should treat all these countries in a different way, in the same way, not in a different way. And then the second thing that I think this is going to be very much important in the future is that recently, if you read the Eurostat, there was this, they say that inflation dropped at 8.5 percentage point. Now, if you look at data, Belgium inflation is 5.4, Latvia is 20%, right? So with respect to some years ago, what happened is that there is a lot of dispersion of inflation among member state countries. So it was not something that we observed before this current crisis. So this means that the same monetary policy will have different effects, not different effects, maybe will have the same effect, but it will either drop inflation a lot in some country or leave some country with very high inflation. So when you want to implement the same fiscal rule, I think you need to take into account that unfortunately, now the monetary policy cannot tackle the inflation exactly as it should be. So if you think that then this will have an effect on the real economy, like having Latvia with 20% inflation will have some effect, then maybe we should find a way to also address this problem with the fiscal rule. So to conclude, I think just like that, the premises, so having a unique fiscal rule is very difficult, and also the main problem derived from the fact that different countries, we have different tradition on fiscal rules, right? So if you think about southern countries, we really want expansion, we really care about, oh, let's expand this. And if instead you look at northern countries, they really care about the debt, right? So they want to have this sort of fiscal rule that is, they don't want to have high level of debt. And so in some sense, on this respect, I don't know how we are going to convert that, but we should look a little bit to the US, where they are a monetary union, and they converge to have some rule that, fiscal rule that everybody agree. But on the side, what we should give up is also, I mean, fiscal, I don't know, it's like not responsibility, but countries should give up part of their fiscal space, and this is also very difficult to enforce. So I'm very happy that I'm an academic, because I don't have to solve this problem. I can also say what is wrong with respect to the policy, but I think it's a very difficult problem to solve, but I think at least the rule should be flexible, enforceable, and fair. Thank you.
Was all time. Thank you, that was great.
So I have spent most of my career dealing with financial crises, and my joke is you typically don't want me showing up in your country unless I'm on holiday. It's normally a bad sign. I had sort of three broad points to make, and for better or for worse, I tend to write everything down for fear of, as a generalist, missing kind of important points. But three broad points. I mean, the first one is, I think fiscal rules are of first order importance politically in the euro area, and probably of second order importance in terms of actually reducing debt. Related to that, I think the new rules as proposed are a substantial improvement over the old ones. They're much more realistic, they're much more honest. They give the requisite flexibility that Federica talked about. There are questions about whether they're sufficiently binding. But they certainly meet the two criteria of simplicity and predictability, to which, you know, most fiscal rules or all fiscal rules should aspire. But the questions, I think, are more around the exceptions and the enforceability and preventing adverse consequences. And I'd probably want to emphasize a little bit that last point with a story to give some context to the fiscal rules. I'm a relative newcomer to the Eurozone. I'm a sort of global strategist. I started out covering Latin America, and again, as the crises spread, I spread, and at some point ended up in the Eurozone. And I was at a forum at a research institute in Brussels, the Bruegel Institute, around 2013. It was a European-Asian forum. And for the first hour, all of the European specialists spent time in the intricacies of banking union and capital markets union, common deposit insurance. And finally, after about an hour, one of the Asian participants raised his hand and said, "I just have one question. Can anyone tell me if the crisis is over?" And I think that's a really important point here. I do worry a little bit that we risk missing the forest for the trees, given all the major structural spending needs that are coming down the pike. The green transition, the digital transition, military spending, given what's happened with Russia and Ukraine, demographics are always there. You know, so at some level, we're in a little bit of a, I don't want to call it a honeymoon phase, but a phase where some of these gaps have been bridged over by the common lending facilities, like the Recovery and Resilience Fund, that sort of buffer the spending needs of these countries through these issues. So let me just elaborate on those three points. You know, the first one is, at least in my view, the fiscal rules are most important given the tricky politics of the union between creditors and debtors. The fights have always been around, can the creditor countries trust the debtor countries to be fiscally responsible? And they've generally not believed that they could be. In spite of the fact that if you look at the debt numbers over time, you know, they've been relatively responsible, I would say, at least in the last decade. And so from my perspective as a market participant, I don't think you can really expect to build on the progress, all of the progress that we've seen over the last decade in intra-Eurozone stabilization mechanisms without fiscal rules that both the creditor and the debtor countries can agree on. So in that sense, we've had an important upgrade. It's a major trust issue, and this is a step forward. The second point is that the rules as devised are asymmetrically defined. What do you need to do to avoid situations that threaten fiscal stability? You've got general escape clauses, you've got national escape clauses, but they will be tightly defined. And the countries are given much more say, as Marco alluded to. I mean, it's a major step forward that countries will be able to effectively design their reform programs, in contrast to the current rules, which sort of force countries or attempt to force countries to do what Brussels or certain more powerful member states demand of them. So I think the way that one might want to look at these rules is more as guardrails. They create good incentives to be efficient in the allocation of public spending. And they are important given the shocks that we've just been through in terms of actually reestablishing a fiscal anchor after very costly pandemic and war shocks, and given all the structural challenges that I mentioned. If you look at the debt statistics over time and you kind of divide, you know, the era of, you know, the euro area in half, 11 years or so on either side, you know, the average over the first 11 years was around 70% debt to GDP for the union as a whole. Now it's around 85. 85 is the new 70. In Italy, it seems like 140 is the new 110. So what we've seen in both of these periods is stability, shock, jump up, stability. You know, and so there's already an indication that at least the rules as they've existed have never really managed to reduce the debt over time. And again, not to blame the rules for this. I mean, it's been a very challenging 20 years. But the point is, I think it's probably more useful to think of these as guardrails rather than as, you know, strict and credible limits that will lead to debt reduction in the foreseeable future. There's also a very heavy focus on reducing procyclicality, which Mark alluded to, which for us I think is hugely important, which I'll get to in my conclusion. and sort of revisiting the experience of 2011. The second point, just in terms of the realism of the new rules, they are risk-based. They're less prone to false expectations. And one reason why the old rules were so difficult to implement, on top of the politics, was that the system had an escalation path and trigger points. And once you triggered one thing, you kind of were on a slippery slope, and it was very difficult to get out of that sort of negative spiral. But then you ended up at the end of that slippery slope, and you found that you had a hammer that was powerless. So what the what is being traded off here is really, we're going from a world of a big hammer that's impotent to a small hammer that has some power. And I think that's actually good progress, because people can communicate the truth. It won't lead you, they can communicate that truth without leading to a path of political escalation. I think the other point is that they do opt for simplicity over comprehensiveness. You know, one counter argument to the point that I made would simply be that we don't have to encompass everything. There's enough flexibility to accommodate. I don't think they'll lead to debt reduction as a result, but as a result of that, at least you have the exceptions kind of make sense. It's just that if you use all the exceptions, you're probably never going to get debt reduction, which I think Federica was alluding to as well. I think another key distinction about the new rules is what Federica alluded to, oh no, Marco alluded to on the transmission protection instrument of the ECB. Federica alluded to this in terms of monetary policy not being appropriate for all of the other countries. These rules tell you nothing about the appropriateness of the policy mix. Mm-hmm. And so if Germany tightens fiscal policy by more than the rules suggest, that's a weakness in the system. Member states like Germany have had much more fiscal space, but ran much tighter fiscal stance over a long period of time, while countries like Italy had an excessively loose fiscal stance. So what you may find is that for the euro area as a whole, you've got rough balance, but the composition is very poor. So what about exceptions and enforceability? I did want to talk briefly about contingent liabilities. Again, that's, I think, a key challenge in devising credible fiscal rules, but they're also one that sort of raised the question as to how ambitious one can be, you know, what they should be trying to achieve. Should they be trying to achieve stable debt or declining debt over time? And there, you know, when I've talked to people who were involved in the drafting and the discussion, the back and forth, they sort of readily admit that there are just certain things that are harder to pin down. You've got pension reforms, for example, that on paper seem to solve a pension sustainability problem, but they're not socially or politically credible. By the time they actually start to bite, you'll have pensioners going hungry, and that's not really a viable solution. But it's very difficult to calculate that ex ante. And then you get climate risk, all kinds of geopolitical issues. So again, without being too critical, I would say that the fiscal framework is good in providing the flexibility to cope with those challenges. It just may not lead to material debt reduction. I have found it very difficult to understand how one would bind a government that is close to an election to a medium-term fiscal program. I'd be curious to hear more from Marco on that, but I think it's really hard to imagine, you know, how a government that has a year left or 6 months left signs a four-year, seven-year, 10-year program, sort of committing to a certain kind of reforms, and then a new government comes in a short time later. How can they be bound to that? Does it have to be renegotiated? The flexibility is in the debt rules for that, but I think it's very challenging to sort of bind countries into multi-year targets when you have elections at play. And there's also a question, obviously, around democratic governance. So let me just sort of cut to the chase. Are we missing the wood for the trees? My own early experience with the Eurozone was around 2009, 2010, when Greece first experienced problems. And there was this cathartic moment in 2010 when Angela Merkel and Nicolas Sarkozy struck an agreement that would provide some sort of fiscal backstop in the form of stabilization support, the creation of the European Stability Mechanism. Correct me if my history is wrong on this.
The famous walk on the beach.
The famous walk on the beach, the infamous walk on the beach for some of us. And in return, there would be the bail-in of private creditors where debt was deemed to be unsustainable. And so the immediate thing that caused was a run on the periphery countries. And most of the countries ended up in programs except for Italy. Now, I don't think we're going back to anything like that. I think that the architecture that has been created over the last 10 years, including during the pandemic, importantly during the pandemic, mitigates that risk. But I think we have to recognize the fragility of the safety net and how that links back to credible fiscal rules that appease all parties involved. There are huge spending pressures ahead. The spending may raise growth potential over time, but it may take time. And we also have to recognize we've got major issues with what we call deglobalization or fragmentation that are working in the opposite direction. Now, the threat of losing market access is a powerful one, and I think that also raises the question in the context of fiscal rules. To what extent do you need fiscal rules if you have the market? I've seen several times in my career where the markets are very poor at playing that disciplining mechanism until it's way too late. But I would also say they haven't played, a poor disciplining mechanism. It's typically when there's an expectation, and let me give you a more recent example of what happened over the weekend with Credit Suisse, where there was an expectation in the market that, you know, there were different sort of layers of the capital structure of the bank that would take a loss in the event of the bank being rendered non-viable. Typically, equity got hit first, and then there was a layer of what we call bail-inable debt, it's sort of half debt, half equity, and then there's the debt. And as part of the solution, the regulators decided that the debt would be bailed in, but the equity would actually be partially paid. And that triggered some immediate contagion across the European banking sector, because the rules of the game, as they were deemed to, as they were believed to be, were suddenly shuffled. And I think that's one thing that we have to keep in mind with the backstops that have been created. The power of the backstops, in many respects, is that they've never been used. The ESM has been used a little bit, but the ECB's facility, the Transmission Protection Instrument, and what was the name of the previous one? OMT. OMT, yes. Neither of them have ever been used. And like the experience that we had with Credit Suisse over the weekend, the buffers worked, but they had a lot of adverse consequences. So bottom line is, I'm very positive on the fiscal rules in terms of them representing an upgrade to what currently exists. Incentive compatible with debt control, good governance goals, less so for debt reduction. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. The pleasure of speaking last means that many of the things I will say are somewhat repetitive, but hopefully it will be more of a summary. But also, I think I'd like to, I think Marco began with a very clear and good exposition of what the Commission is trying to do in terms of fiscal rules, but I'd like to contextualize this in terms of what the challenge the Commission really faced, the balance that it's trying to set here. And so in this regard, I'd like to point out that strict fiscal rules among non-EU countries, high-income countries, is rather rare. Most of the rules of of high-income countries outside the EU are very, very loose relative to what the original charter of Maastricht planned. And so I think that kind of already highlights a challenge. European unity was trying to do something that really had not been tried on this scale before, certainly by doing this with a, you know, with a multinational institution, a transnational institution. And as Marco pointed out, the EU itself is rethinking those fiscal rules and is now, you know, coming up with, I think, I agree, improvements in this regard. In terms of the academic discussion of this topic, I think this also mirrors the fact that the discussions have moved from these polar views of either we do rules or we do discretion to many intermediate and more subtle regimes, and I think that's also where the EU is converging. So let me try to highlight what I view as the current view of fiscal rules. Number one, and this is reflected in Marco and the Commission's plans, is moves from public debt and deficit rules, which are viewed as endogenous outcomes of a lot of things, to public spending rules. And there is some component of that in the Commission's plans. Here are a few kind of citations of research that has been advocating of a movement in that direction. And number two is that rules should try to bake in as much as possible counter-cyclical clauses and or escape clauses so as to not be so rigid, to be impractical, unenforceable, and undesirable. With that in mind, I agree with this consensus. I think it's reasonable, first of all, to allow automatic stabilizers to operate, to have counter-cyclical fiscal policy baked in some way or another into the rules. But at some level, I don't think this goes far enough. And I'm not sure, you know, so to be fair, I don't know how to implement going far enough in that direction. So there's, you know, there's the armchair academic view and there's the real world that that Marco lives in. But we saw that, you know, automatic stabilizers, any type of fiscal rule in COVID-19 would have had to gone through the it's hard to imagine a fiscal rule that wouldn't have been thrown through the window during COVID-19. And you know, we think we can imagine the unimaginable, and then the unimaginable happened. So we don't know what the next big thing is going to be that will require an escape clause, and I don't know how we're going to ever bake in all these contingencies. Indeed, I think the movement to more loose rules and has a lot of these pragmatic components in this, and so I'm, you know, this is not meant as in any way, I hope this is not coming through as a critique of what the Commission is doing, but rather contextualizing the real challenge what a hard problem they are trying to solve. So as I said, counter-cyclical problem, to having good counter-cyclical rules is easier said than done. To have a rule that is counter-cyclical, you need to know what the state of the cycle, and nobody knows how to measure the state of the cycle. I, for years, have been saying, forget about these output gaps and all these things, just look at unemployment. And then COVID-19 taught me that I can't look at unemployment either, because in those rare circumstances, unemployment is a meaning, I don't know who's employed and who's unemployed. So, you know, I thought I had a you know, half good solution, and now even that solution is no good anymore. There have been alternative proposals to replace fiscal rules with fiscal councils, perhaps with soft, vague, budget rules or norms. And so I think kind of probably the most influential of this is the Blanchard et al. Work and Yann Olivier's writing on this topic, that his call to move some form of council or have the European Court of Justice adjudicate whether countries are being fiscally sustainable enough. Kind of the notion is that, you know, I know fiscal, the kind of the statement about pornography, you know it when you see it, so you know fiscal unsustainability, you know fiscal unsustainability when you see it, and so just let a court come in and adjudicate that. I think this is not a good substitute for the current framework, so in some sense I'm saying there are no easy outs here. So this chart you see here, you know, kind of looks at fiscal councils around the world, and as you can see from that chart, almost none of them can actually bite. Okay, so this notion that we'll have a court of law, international court of law, actually, you know, adjudicating and trying to enforce externally. This, you know, through some council type of process, the fiscal rules is not something that's really been tried elsewhere, even within the domestic legal system, let alone within an international, the complexity of an international system. I think the bigger problem with this fiscal norm view, this view of, you'll know fiscal unsustainability when you see it, is perhaps the Germans will notice fiscal unsustainability in Italy, notice that, while the Italians will not notice the fiscal sustainability. There will be differences of opinions how to interpret these vague rules and norms, and I think this would really risk actually eroding European unity further and trust in international institutions further, because a vague rule will by necessity require judgment of a legal system or some unelected council to adjudicate. So I think that fiscal councils, you know, do not provide a substitute for the current fiscal rule. I should also point out that most of the fiscal councils are in countries that also have fiscal rules. So these are not substitutes, as in some sense Blanchard and others are recommending where they are implemented, but rather complements. These will typically be institutions, these fiscal councils, that will try to either assess what the output gap is and therefore assess whether a country, the country should receive a break clause, or to assess whether the fiscal rule is being implemented by you know to its word or not. I'd like to end with another challenge, which I fear that we are ignoring, and I think ignoring at our peril. So this is GDP in Greece. If you haven't seen this picture before, then you should look at it carefully, because this is, you know, truly a disaster of colossal magnitudes with many human implications. GDP now is about a quarter below what it was, still now, a quarter below what it was in its 2008 peak. I should emphasize that in 2008, there was 3% inflation, so you could think this was an unsustainable path, but there was no indication of overheating by traditional measures. So I challenge us to question why Greece's potential is any less than it was in 2008. Its potential output was any less than its 2008. As I said when I presented the same version of this talk at ECFIN, I said, I give you the minimum of, you know, the maximum of your estimate and Greece's GDP in 2008 as the output, as the potential output of Greece, because we know it was not overheating by, you know, the clear measure of, you know, inflation and unemployment, which are telling us the stories. Yes, there's been out-migration, but that in itself is endogenous to the economic conditions. And this is in the context of government spending having declined by 40%, so actually even going down 10% with respect to to GDP. So before I say what I do mean by this, let me be very clear about what I don't mean by this. I don't mean that the fiscal contraction caused the disaster in Greece. I don't mean that fiscal policy was appropriate before the crisis, or that debt was sustainable at that point. But what I would like to say is that we need to at least entertain the possibility that the massive scarring that the Greece economy has experienced is at least partially due to the massive cuts in public spending that were associated with this. Again, I'm also not saying that the European Commission, the one more thing that I should say that should I would clarify about this, things would have been much worse without the EU. Okay, if they had just defaulted on their debt and gone to autarky, they wouldn't even be able to spend as much as they did spend here. So this is not to point a blaming finger at the European Commission or at any other country. This is entirely a self-inflicted blow. But I, as an empirical matter, I feel we have to entertain the possibility of the scarring effects of government spending. So this is not just short-run counter-cyclical measures, but the possibility that the potential output of an economy is permanently damaged through measures, and so that we really have to be very vigilant about this counter-cyclical component of fiscal policy and allow it really to play out with within whatever institutional fiscal mechanism we use. So just to end on that point, there is a growing literature that points to the risks not only of excessive borrowing, that's not the only thing that can go wrong with fiscal policy, but there can also be reasons why there is insufficient borrowing under certain circumstances. We have a literature about the shortage of safe assets, and now interest rates are going up, so maybe they're not as safe as they were perceived, so they're safe until they're not safe anymore. But in any case, there is a risk when we think about a country like the US, and as was pointed out before, if we think about a country like Germany, there is a possibility that some of these countries have underborrowed rather than overborrowed, and that is a distinct possibility. And I don't know how we allow that into our fiscal rules. We have a literature on hysteresis and stagnation traps, which I think are good explanations for what we saw in Greece and also in Italy during the crisis. And I have my own work showing how increases in government spending can affect TFP so that potential output is endogenous. I would imagine that the reverse is also true, that cuts in government spending could harm TFP, so treating TFP as though, and potential output, as though those are exogenous targets that we should meet, has the risk of potential output defeatism, in which we declare for example, in the case of Greece, the output gap was estimated to be only 3 to 4% around, at the eve of COVID-19, while unemployment was still, well into double digits. So we are kind of declaring defeat, giving up on this country, on its potential, because we ignore the long run impacts of these policies. So that's
very good. Thank you. And we're running about 10 minutes over time, so I'm going to do a round of questions. I'm going to ask you to spend 2 or 3 minutes on the answer so that we also have some time to get questions from the floor. So I'm going to go over each of the panelists and in many ways ask you to react to, I think, some things that the other said. So starting in the same order, Marco, and this I think should be dear to your heart because you've written about this. As was stated by both Jean and Ethan, the rules that we have in the EU were in part set as ceilings to prevent excessive debt accumulation, up to 3%, up to 60% if you go back to Maastricht. However, and at the same time, I think we understand well today, and I think we even understand it before, that fiscal policy, what we would like is to achieve the correct policy mix between fiscal policy mix across regions as well as mix with monetary policy and others. In the new framework, is there a move to, from ceilings towards mix? If not, what do we, why do you see that as infeasible, or what do you think are the barriers to achieve that?
Okay, no, I think good question, and it relates also to what I think Federica, I think Ethan said. Okay, I give you my assessment based on, say, of you know, fiscal coordination, fiscal surveillance of the past many years, and I draw, I think, I have, I'm always in doubt as an economist to draw firm conclusions, but one conclusion I draw firmly. It is virtually impossible to achieve the right fiscal stance, let's say, for the Union or for the Eurozone as a whole, solely via, let's say, horizontal coordination of national policies. So, it is true, I think it was said before, I think by both of you, and you recorded, Ricardo, I mean, there may be some, may have been, let's say, under-borrowing by Germany. There is no way we can force Germany to talk about Germany, you know, or another country, to do something which is not in perceived as their own interest for the sake of the aggregate fiscal stance for the, say, for the Eurozone as a whole to come to a right policy mix. So, I think this is, we have failed when we repeatedly, you know, suggested, recommended to Germany to do something also related to the macroeconomic imbalances, procedure, excessive external surplus. There was no way to achieve that. So how do you achieve then the right fiscal stance, you know, contributing to the right policy mix? I think we are, instead of horizontal coordination, I think we will have to think about vertical coordination. So meaning trying to put in, try to achieve what other federations or quasi-federations around the world have, which is a proper central budget. And a proper central budget has, you know, it has the function of it can have a stabilization function, which is, you know, responding more or less automatically to the, you know, to shocks in the cycle. So that can be there. Or, and this is, if you take a Musgrave perspective, this is more the stabilization function. If you think about more allocation type, which can, you know, via the allocation, you can actually achieve also the right fiscal stance in macroeconomic terms, and that is more supplying of European public goods. So what you should do at the European level, because if you apply the principle of fiscal federalism, there is something that, you know, that you should be doing at that level there, not in, you know, a decentralized level. So that is, if you think about public goods, come out of the crisis here with the war, energy, etc. So security, energy, transnational projects on the green transition, etc. Now, this element here, the central fiscal capacity, is not in our proposals. Because we thought that, I think we said that it would be actually a very good idea. It was recommended in our public consultation by most economists and all the international institutions, IMF, OECD, also the ECB suggested that, but we thought that since it is still very controversial, it would have, I think, created problems for the rest of the... so I think the answer here is that we try to have a system which has some more anti-cyclical properties. Whether that is enough to achieve you know, the proper fiscal stance on and the right policy mix, I think there is a question mark, and I think we are not there yet.
I mean, I just say one word just to relate a bit to the literature, you know, also in the, I mean, what you have, I mean, what you mentioned, Ricardo, what motivated the 3%, 60% was the willingness to avoid fiscal dominance. So at the time, so we had, and the references were the Sargent and Wallace unpleasant monetary arithmetics, you know, that was one thing, or the fiscal theory, the price level, that's another, you know, another reference for that type of, to motivate that type of things. Now, I think the experience, and I've written in my book also, on during the global financial crisis, was that paradoxically, we had fiscal dominance by excessive fiscal restriction. Because we pushed the ECB, you know, back against the wall, because it was the period of very low inflation, borderline deflation, because the ECB had to do, in a sense, to take charge of that, because fiscal policy did not do enough in sustaining demand. So, in a sense, it was Sargent and Wallace on the head. So that is what the experience we had. I think we did very well in responding to COVID by a next generation EU and recovery and resilience facility. I think that was the right response at the time. Why did, and I conclude on this, why did we manage to do it in response to the COVID, and why not in response to the global financial crisis? And Greece here comes as an element, as an important element. In the global financial crisis, the perception, the interpretation was that this was a policy-induced crisis. So, and Greece, in the first place, you know, represented the quintessential moral hazard problem. I mean, the crisis originated with Greece on cheating on the budget, and I mean, all of a sudden we went from 2.7 to 15%, etc. So we read the crisis at that time through fiscal lenses and through moral hazard. So the element of punishment, in inverted commas, a bit behind your figure, had the roots there. COVID, clearly, there was no moral hazard problems. So one could respond in a more, you know, in a more effective way centrally. So at least on a temporary basis, we had this central fiscal tool which helped to respond to the shock.
Very good. Let's try to catch up. Federica, I wanted to ask you on a point that was made. So you've made the point that we have shifted from deficit to spending rules, one, and two, that there's very large investments along the way. If I think about your criteria of feasibility, enforceability, fairness, would you say that the shift from deficit to spending, one, and two, the inevitability that there's at least very ambitious investment plans lead you to say, well, at the light of your criteria, you're pessimistic, this won't make much of a difference, or do you think that this is progress towards achieving the aims that you set out?
I think like it's a sort of progress, right? So in some sense, it's like maybe it's not the perfect rule, but it's going towards that direction, and it's like helped the government at least to have, like, I think, like, Eden and also, I mean, everybody was speaking about that, to have rules that are like, they're going to take into account which point of the business cycle you are, and to tackle or to have some fiscal stabilizer in place. So I think that is like a positive thing. So I was trying to be short.
Oh, good, thank
you. This is like 10 minutes. Okay. Good idea.
Jean, you mentioned, and good thing you mentioned also what's going on now in the financial markets. We've been talking a lot about fiscal. We learned certainly 10, 15 years ago that these things can be very tightly connected, that what starts with problems in the banks spills over to problems in the fiscal, that spills back, and we get into these loops that are very dangerous. We are now have very high debt. We are having some disturbance in financial markets. I don't want this to forecast here the end of the world in any way, but do you think that that's, going back to your forest of the trees, do you think that there's a possibility in the next month, 2 months, 6 months, even as we're discussing rules for the next 10 years, we end up getting into one of these loops, vortexes of misery as the financial banks and debts as the banks and the public debt interact, or no?
Yeah, I wouldn't I wouldn't have thought it's, you know, it will be particularly related to the level of debt. But I do think that, you know, we are sort of constantly reminded, you know, to your point on sort of inverted Sergeant Wallace, how, you know, what theory would tell us is sometimes turned on its head. Not that runs on banks are, you know, subversion of any theory, but the notion that you have a loss of confidence in banks that don't have an asset quality problem, the lost money, you know, investing in government bonds is a little bit bizarre. And so I think that changes our perception of what could, you know, what can go wrong. So I would certainly not say that the probability is zero. I would just say, however, that, you know, I think that risk in the periphery and the more vulnerable, quote unquote, vulnerable countries of the Eurozone is less right now because of the strength of nominal growth. And so inflation is helping a lot. If one believes in the credibility of the central banks, that will not be a problem that's with us for too much longer, in which case, you know, these challenges will come back to the fore.
Very good. Ethan, a point that was brought, I forget now, maybe by Federica or others, was the importance of trust in the political economy, you know, whether we're discussing councils, rules, or others. To what extent do you think that that trust even exists, such that it's feasible to discuss this? Or even better, let's be more constructive, and especially because you've also worked quite a bit in political economy and some trust issues. What do you think are things that actually can do to improve trust, as opposed to complaining there isn't enough trust? What can we do to improve trust in this very narrow sense of allowing for better fiscal coordination rules or councils?
Okay, so actually, if you'll allow me, I just want one word to what Marco said earlier. And this is not just to, you know, this is not a debate, because I actually agree with 100% with what you said. But I wanted to point out on the Greek case, but also more generally, that I've studied the pro-cyclical fiscal policies in developing countries and high-income countries. And one conclusion that I've drawn is that pro-cyclicality is much more on the upside than on the downside. Mm. That is, it's more that countries overborrow when times are good than they underborrow in the recession. And the problem with that, so in that sense, I 100% agree with you that it's, you know, Greece dug its own grave in some sense in the 2000s up to 2010. Having said that, that also highlights the challenge of fiscal rules with bite. Because when everything's going well, it's very hard to find sanctions that will actually matter to that country. So you give them a little slap on the wrist, but GDP is booming, and nobody really cares about that. So Andres can tell us how hard it is when the economy is booming to actually implement these rules. And then when the economy is crashing, it's very painful to impose these punishments on these countries at that point. So I see this kind of as again, I don't have a perfect solution to that, and in fact, I have no better solution to what is already being done. On the question of trust, I mean, I guess it's a question of whose trust in what. Is it the trust in of the markets that the fiscal rule will really be, followed, and you know what needs to be done in that respect? Is it trusts of the countries in the European Commission that will, you know, evaluate their stance correctly? So I'm a little bit waffling on that question, because I actually don't really know. I think it's trust is a complicated thing, and I'm not sure. I would throw the question to you, Ricardo, to take the analogy from monetary policy. We kind of have, you know, inflation expectations are so stable that we think that actually, you know, maybe we trust our central banks by now a little too much. So what were the things that central banks did, an analogy, to gain so much trust? Is it their independence, which is never going to happen with fiscal policy? Is it following implicit rules that has helped? So what would you say, Ricardo?
Well, I shouldn't, but I think it was the combination of having a very narrow and clear objective
and delivering it for 15 years. I mean, if you've delivered a 2% for 15, 20 years, either by luck or skill, then people indeed go and trust you very much. And you've been very clear that that is the goal that you have pursued. I think Invisible Ball is always going to be hard, but if the rule, maybe the new one, delivers in the next 10 years and things are always seen as obeying the rule and is supported, say, complemented by a fiscal council, then I can see that trust arising when it comes to, again, people's expectations. Let's open to the audience, though. We only have like 4 or 5 minutes, so I'm going to only ask on 2 questions. So I'm going to start here with Martin, and the microphone is there. Oh, sorry.
Thank you very much for the interesting panel. I wanted to ask Marco Butti about how the European Commission thinks about the effects of the slowdown of productivity growth, and especially how that should affect fiscal rules. So on the one hand, with Southern Europe having zero or even negative productivity growth, that means that fiscal space is declining. At the same time, productivity growth is calling for big government intervention, right? So large subsidies, big infrastructural investments. So how should fiscal rules adapt to persistently lower productivity growth?
Can I ask a quick question?
Yeah. Very quick comment and a question. The comment is on fiscal councils. We have central banks because we cannot specify all contingencies in a rule, so we delegate that work to human beings. If you believe that is true, then having a fiscal council instead of a rule might make sense. However, and I'm going to agree with Ethan here, the difference is that central banks directly control the relevant instrument, the interest rate, whereas fiscal councils very indirectly control the relevant instrument, whether it's taxes or expenditure, and therefore the analogy breaks down, and having a council instead of a rule, as opposed to having a council on top of a rule, simply won't work. That's my 30-second comment. My question is this. Fiscal rules are good or bad depending what problem you're trying to solve. The problem that I think we're trying to solve is that the underlying political economy of a country is bad, and therefore we're making the wrong choices. We're borrowing too much, and we're shifting expenditure into temporarily in a way that's inefficient, etc. If we make the rule softer, more flexible, more realistic, you know, who can be against more flexible, more realistic? That sounds really good, right? But are we not throwing away the main feature of this rule, namely, political players within the country have to view it as a constraint because otherwise it will not modify their behavior and therefore the disciplining feature of the rule will go out. So I worry, I'm sounding really right wing here, so forgive me, I don't mean to, but I worry that by making the rule be so realistic and so adaptable and so flexible and all these things that sound so good, we're actually throwing away the main feature that rules need to have.
Very good. I'm going to go in reverse order than we've done, so I'm going to start with you, Ethan, so that you could either answer or just give your last minute, since this is going to be the last time you use the word.
Okay. No, so I probably will cede most of that that time just to agree with the questions, and I'll pass on.
All I would say to Andres's question, but I think Marco will say it as well. I mean, I do think that, you know, there is a link to the there is sort of the enforcement part. So there is that length. You can still go to that as a function of 3% deficit. And the idea that the government has to design the program. I mean, you're still, we didn't talk a lot about, you know, the binding part in terms of the debt sustainability analysis that will be devised. And maybe it, you know, maybe there is too much discretion there. So that is a weak point. But it will be around each country's, as I understand it, debt sustainability analysis with some kind of conservatism for the shocks that, you know, tend to be asymmetric, and the ability of the country to own it, design the programs that make it sort of consistent. So I think that's a positive innovation. I think the concern is really the trust part is over who should adjudicate that. Should it be the commission, you know?
I think the question is.
Marco, go for it. You have the last word, Marco.
Allocation, so productivity issue slowdown. Okay, we have secular slowdown of productivity. We have seen it, I think throughout the world. We have it. We have a particular problem in Europe and Southern Europe. You look at estimates of total factor productivity, you know, border zero to borderline, you know, negative in a number of countries there. So That's why we are trying, and I've tried to explain there, we are trying to provide incentives in order to reallocate spending towards those good items and good purposes. Is it going to be enough? I don't think it's going to be enough per se. That's why before I talked about investment in European public goods, which could also be addressed to the boost in the productivity, addressing the productivity channel. Now, yes, I think, Jean, you have answered, I think, rightly, so thank you. no, and here, I think what we have had in the past years was nominally tough rules with a lot of flexibility to play. So what we are trying to do now, and in a sense, being projected down from Brussels. So what we are trying to do now is to reduce the nominal stringency, throw the ball to the member states so that they can commit themselves to their own path, and then, and that is the challenge, to have more enforceability of the rule of the rules themselves. So in a sense, it is gradualism is not synonymous of flexibility in this sense. I want to say a word finally on the councils and fiscal councils. First of all, I didn't mention it, but we have fiscal councils in the EU, and we have also a European fiscal board which is advising the Commission. So it, small in with I think notable academics in that. But I tell you a little story, and the story is of a few days ago. When we were with the ministers in ECOFIN negotiating what I had in my final slide, which is the conclusions on reform of the economic governance adopted on the 13th and 14th of March, the issue was what to do with the fiscal councils. Because, in our proposal, I didn't mention it, but in our proposal, we said we should strengthen review the fiscal, the mandate and prerogatives of the fiscal councils, national fiscal councils. And we said, okay, let's review also what we can do with the European Fiscal Board. So this is, come to the drafting of the council conclusions. What happened there was that the ministers and the delegates, obviously, strengthened the part on the fiscal board to have more control on Commission, EU, etc., and they softened the part on national fiscal councils. So, in a sense, they did not want to be to have a watchdog there. Okay, I have to say that. I don't think, and this was, the fiscal standards of Blanchard et al., which has this, by the way, the European European Court, they are kicking in the implementation of the standards. I think if you look at the composition of the authorship of that paper, you can locate it to this, towards the Z. so it was an uneasy compromise over that paper there. But nonetheless, I think what we have is that fiscal councils, they are very heterogeneous in the EU. So you have some with a good tradition. Tim Bergen inspired the Dutch, and others much less good. And actually, there is a bit of a paradox here, is that, or maybe not, countries like Germany or other fiscally rigorous countries have very weak fiscal councils, very weak. The degree of independence is very questionable, and they do not have much they have much of a role there. So this heterogeneity makes it difficult, a historical tradition makes it difficult to attribute to them too much power. And then also there is a final consideration, is that if you entrust independent authorities like the fiscal councils with politically heavy decisions, their independence tends to be challenged. You know, the risk of capture at the political level is important. So one has to, you know, if you give too much power, then you may regret it afterwards.
Very good. So thank you so much. Sorry for being 5 minutes over for those of you. Thank you for joining us. I think this was a really interesting and very wide-ranging debate. And some of us will continue at dinner hosted by Andres. Thank you so much.